Massive thank you as always to patrons Sarah Turner, Rebecca Johns, and Justin Harper. And this week's random call out goes to patron Callista Salazar. You can support us too at patreon.com/isnotjustinyourhead, or follow us on social media and help spread the word. For those new to the show, my name is Liam, and I edit and produce the podcast, as well as do some backseat co-hosting. For regular listeners, co-host Max Golding has recently posted on our Patreon Discord because he's leaving the show, sadly, due to lots of life commitments. His post is worth a read. Hopefully he'll pop back now and again. However, before he left, we all spent some time trying to find a replacement co-host. And today, New York-based psychotherapist Harriet Fraud chats with our new co-host, Ikoi Hiro, a substance use disorder counsellor. And what follows is a wide-ranging discussion. As for the rest of the month, we have various guests lined up. Susan Rosenthal to discuss capitalism and mental health. Catherine Liu to discuss how trauma is used by the professional managerial class. And author John Bales, extending our conversation from last month with Dr. Alfie Bowne about video games and desire. We're going to be discussing how certain video games naturalize neoliberal ideology. It should be an exciting month.
In the mental health field, too often, we've made it seem as if it's just in your head. Just in your head.
If the landlord can hijack the rent by 20%, that impacts people's mental health.
We can't have a profit-driven mental health care system if we want our people to be connected and healthy.
I was wondering, what kind of vision do you have for it's not just in your head? What kind of speakers do you want? Why did you join it? What do you think? You know, what do you want to do with this?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, mental health is such an expansive field. It's a developing field in many ways, you know. And I mean, one aspect, I guess, of the more, I would say, troubling trend in mental health, right, is, I mean, on one hand, it makes sense to, like, you know, the whole DSM thing with, you know, how it used to be the Greek numerals and now it's the Arabic. That's to, like, match the medical side, right? You know, and so it's kind of like, on one hand, mental health, you know, and at least, like, the brain is part of the body. So that merging with the medical infrastructure is not necessarily a bad thing. There is an important component to it. But one of the aspects that it's going is, like, it's becoming almost too strictly biochemical, right? You know, with, like, very little regard kind of taken to, like, you know, how people's behaviors develop over time, you know, and, like, and to a certain degree, like, nothing against mental health medication because they are lifesavers and vital for people.
Sometimes, but they are.
Yeah. But at the same time, like, there is a tendency to, I think the focus on the biochemical has to do more with expedience than actually a regard for regarding patients holistically.
Yeah. Also, I think there is a political component to try to make it your biology rather than the social forces,
right,
that are warping you and making it hard to live.
Right.
The political economy aspect is excised from the equation.
Absolutely.
With biochemical, which is another thing I think we all want to challenge.
Right, and that's part of, like, the whole kind of the title, right, that it's not,
yes,
just in your head, you know, that it's not just a chemical thing, but, you know, it's many things coming together. Yeah, that's, you know, being able to talk about the social, the political, the environmental, you know, all these different contexts in mental health is really, really important. So I guess that's one of the aspects of it. And another is just that, yeah, it is such, it's a field where, you know, on one hand, people say, like, oh, science adapts to incoming information, but it actually doesn't really, you know, and it's kind of, you know, it's a area where, you know, the incoming information and the adaptation is kind of a huge conflict.
It's interesting that the National Institutes of Mental Health have said that the DSM is limited and too limited because it doesn't take into consideration the etiology, the origin of the problem, but they,
right,
don't have the advertising budget of psychopharma. So that message is lost.
Right.
And we need to bring it back.
A month or so ago when Max Herriot and I initially spoke to you, was just that you had a sort of different experience as well, like what you're doing now, what your background is. I don't know if you wanted to sort of talk about, you know, how you work at the minute and what your sort of day-to-day is.
Well, yeah, I mean, right. I actually ended up leaving the facility because there are COVID employee protections, as you might guess, was terrible. And yeah, we ended up losing staff. Like, you know, staff ended up dying because of it.
Whoa.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of those things where, like, the death of the staff was kind of like, you know, oh, we don't know if he died of that. We don't have confirmation, you know.
Yeah, well, just in case he died of that, it would be worth not taking the chance of dying.
I was like, okay, like, you guys literally do not pay me enough to
die, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it does seem like the kind of corporate decision-making that's being pushed in the United States now, that workers should go back after 5 days, especially health workers,
right,
because they want more. Too bad for you if you're going to die. You know, that there is a push. We have to make money. We have to keep operating. You're going to be sacrificed.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, the care sector has always worked on an efficiency model, not a redundancy model. And what the care sector always needs is a redundancy model, right?
What do you mean by that?
In terms of staffing, you know, we should always have more, like, we
right,
should have a lot more staff than we think we need.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we understand backing up data.
Right.
But we don't seem to, you know, want to back up staff, right?
That's very important. That's what those 60,000 nurses were on strike against.
Right.
That they needed more nurses in order to give reasonable care.
Yeah, proper care, you know. And I mean, you know, social services have always worked on, like, you know, shoestrings in terms of, like, budget and staffing, you know.
Right.
So, on one hand, you know, like, I understand that the extreme understaffing means you often can't enforce things. But at the same time, you know, it just got to the point where
it's too dangerous.
Yeah.
At this point, it's too dangerous. I think that's why those 60,000 nurses went on strike in Boston and against Kaiser in California. Because to ask people to work that hard and then expose them to COVID when they're already exhausted and their immune systems are down from coping is a high price to pay.
Yeah.
In the U.S. now, 1 out of 5 healthcare workers has quit.
Yeah, or gone into different sectors. At least they're not in emergency care.
Right.
Right. You know, emergency and hospital care. That's
right,
where they're really shedding, you know. Yeah. Yeah,
it's sort of interesting because in the UK, obviously, there's a slightly different different circumstance because of the NHS, right? However, they have been sort of consistently underfunded for the last 10 years and overrun and overworked. And then this past couple of years has obviously been intense and horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And now it just seems like the government's take on this whole thing is just hands off, complete apathy, and the hospitals are just sort of overrun. And in one particular part of the country, they've said, yeah, you just have to make your own way to hospital because, you know, there's not enough ambulances. And so everything's just sort of got really chaotic here. And I think, you know, I guess it's maybe easy to guess why, right? Which is that just they want the NHS stands as something sort of socialist, ultimately, that is not compatible with sort of neoliberal politics or ideology, and they just want to run it into the ground so that everyone jumps ship to, you know, to private practice or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's a very, you know, I think Noam Chomsky, often talks about how like underfunding public services is like the first step to privatization, right?
Yes.
You know, and that's been like an obvious thing that's happening with the NHS, not just the NHS, in a lot of countries with socialized medicine is seeing a lot of privatization creep in.
Yeah, although the United States now leads the whole world in death of COVID because it's entirely market driven. So it's the counterweight example.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's more than 800,000 who have died. Whereas in countries where the government is very involved, even if it's authoritarian, in China, where it started, about 5,000 people have died.
Right.
And in New Zealand, 51 people have died. I mean, it's shocking, the discrepancy.
It depends on your definition of authoritarian, right? Because on one hand,
right,
obviously China has not a great track record of sort of human
civil rights.
Yeah, and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. However, you could say like it's some sort of screwed up authoritarianism, right, that just means that everyone has to die for capital.
Exactly.
Right.
They keep their people safe in this city of Xi'an, which has 13 million people. They close the borders. They don't care if they're making money in Xi'an. They're closing it down because
I think
a few cases.
I think they're also, I'm not sure if this is, they're also facing another outbreak there.
I guess
it's the
all
Hanta
over
virus.
The world. Yeah, well, all over the world, because there is no supply of vaccines and boosters for the entire world. World travel, right, means world spread. And
oh, yeah. No, I mean, like, there's another virus that they're also dealing with in the region.
Right. However, yeah, on the other hand, they stockpile virus, whereas in the United States, they don't, because they're making money and you don't get money for the stockpile until it turns over. So they,
right,
wait until people are very sick and then start producing, which is why we don't have sufficient tests, even in New York,
yeah,
City. It's crazy.
Well, I mean, Abbott destroyed like over, what is it? Was it 10 million tests or something,
right,
back in the summer because they overproduced?
Right.
Again, like this efficiency model and not a redundancy model. Like, it's not this idea of, oh, let's keep it around because we might need it later. It's,
yes,
you know, destroy stocks now so that
keep
we can
up
maintain
the price.
Prices. Right.
Exactly. So that these tests, first of all, two scientists invented a test which they did not patent and they want available to the whole world, which is wildly cheaper. But because nobody was making money off it in the United States, we didn't subscribe. It's all, yeah, over Africa. But, you know, then there's also the fact that the tests, which are supposed to be regulated by the government and no more than $5 for two tests, are now selling for $35.
Right. Right.
Because the people can make more profit down the line. So that profit really, one of the things that I think we have to emphasize is how much profit interferes with mental health and any other medical care.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think to a degree, like, drug rehab is one of the rare exceptions. And I say rare exceptions in that, like, paying more doesn't necessarily get you good care.
Right.
You know, you get like spa services, but that's not necessarily.
That's right.
You and know, so it's kind of, you know, you get your like custom, you know, catered menu and, you know, your meals are cooked by a chef. But, you know, does that necessarily translate to like getting care for your problems? No.
Exactly. You know? Ever since they allowed rehab to be covered by affordable care, all these totally unqualified people have sprung up claiming,
oh,
that they are addiction specialists and creating,
right,
what you call spa care. I mean, it's perverse.
Or just, you know, I mean, one of the major issues is like sober living facilities and how they really exploit you know,
right.
people. Yeah. And people leaving. Right. And, you know, the profit motive does kind of incentivize a lot of places to focus more on customer service than providing care.
Yes.
Because returning customers are also very profitable.
Yes, that's right. And by not treating the addiction, you can be sure they come back.
I'll say in the intro bit, you know, the job that you do or were doing in particular, which to do with people with drug addiction, right? And it, and that place was mm-hmm. to do with homeless people, correct?
Right. Right. We were a LGBT Medicaid-funded facility that worked with majority housing insecure and homeless LGBT populations.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So we can dig into that. But just as a sort of side, you were just talking about a sober something rather. I'm not
sober living. Sober living.
Can you explain what that is? Or
okay, so a lot of times when you leave rehab, right, you know, what they do, what's often recommended is it's kind of like a halfway house, right, where, you know, you pay rent and you live there and you're drug tested there. And so it's kind of like a step. It's supposed to be like a step from going from like a completely controlled environment to a less controlled environment before you're like set free to society, mm-hmm. right? So to help you, yeah, I mean, like the concept in itself isn't necessarily bad. It's to help
no.
people maintain sobriety once they leave a facility, right? Mm-hmm. That they get some services, you know, after leaving a facility. But one of the major issues is one, like, of course, there's it's expensive. There's, you know, a huge lack of number of these housings available. A lot of, you know, sometimes like, you know, courts will require it. Yeah. And it's one of those things where, like, you know, what it, how it ends up functioning oftentimes,
yeah.
you know, is that, you know, one, like, it's not necessarily like these places are again often run for profit.
Yes.
You know, and so, you know, when you're talking about like people still in, you know, a fairly delicate place in their life, right? You know, stuffing, you know, bunch of them together in a house, you know, very oftentimes very unmanaged, where like, you know, there's nobody to really deal with like the interpersonal conflicts that come up, you know, because usually it's, you don't get your own room, you share rooms, right?
Right. Okay. That's intense.
Right. Which is always kind of like, you know, as an adult, especially, right?
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, stoking conflict right there.
You yes. know,
very rarely are halfway, you know, sober livings managed well.
Yes.
You know, in a way that, like, ideally you would think of good management, right? Of, like, there being, like, you know, people always available to, like, talk to and have your concerns discussed. You know, is it sanitary? Is it safe? Are they really maintaining a certain level of safety, which includes, like, actively managing conflicts between residents, you know, but because it's run for profit, it's kind of just like a mill of money.
Yes.
For a lot of these, you know, profit run sober living places.
It also seems to me that it's an invitation to abuse, because in those cases where they have it over you, that if they report that you're not cooperative, you go to jail.
Right. You go to jail
blackmail.
Or just even like, you know, I mean, just even a lot of people don't necessarily have another place they can go.
Right. And so
you know?
One can threaten them and coerce them in
right.
ways that are sick.
There was a big article about it. If I find it again, I'll send it to you guys on email. But, you know, like sexual abuse is rampant,
yes.
right, in this industry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, you know, like I remember talking to a friend of mine, and because I post a lot about like the drug rehab industry on my Facebook, you know, and one of my Facebook friends who, you know, was just like, oh yeah, like I never wanted to talk about this because normal people wouldn't believe me. You know, I can't tell you the number of times my mom was in rehab where she was propositioned sexually by her counselors.
I'm not surprised. And also, since they don't institute peer review at these places, there is no accountability. And I think wherever you don't have checks and accountability, you're going to have abuse.
Yeah.
And there is none here.
And I think what also one of the major issues with kind of like, you know, 12 steps and how they kind of merge with like counseling is like a lot of counselors have experience as a sponsor in 12 steps, you know, and the role of sponsoring somebody and a role of counseling somebody is a very, very different role. It's an incredibly different role. And a lot of times they get that confused, you know, so they treat their counseling like they would as if they were a sponsor.
Can you elaborate on that, the difference?
Well, like sponsorship is very much more of a personal, intimate connection, right?
A friend, right?
Yeah. It is much more of a, you know, a friend rather than like a, there is a certain professional relationship aspect to, you know, your therapist, your counselor, right, your caseworker, your case manager, that, you know, is very, like, you know, your sponsor is somebody that you can technically call at 2 a.m.
Yes.
Right? You know, your therapist, you can't do that. Your counselor, you can't, you know. And so it's one of those things where, like, there are certain professional divides that are really important to adhere to in this field. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times, you know, when they come from that, the sponsoring sector, it can be harder to make those kinds of
boundaries, really.
Yeah. You know, and it's also just one of those things where, like, to a certain degree, a lot of times people kind of function on, this is what worked for me, so this is what works on everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not necessarily true. Yeah.
Right. It really is important to get your perspective because you are in a particularly fraught situation there. 100,000 Americans died of overdoses from 2020 to 2021.
Yeah.
So that.
Yeah, we hit a record.
Just like we did with COVID deaths. The United States is a world leader in many aspects.
Right.
You know, it's hugely important and hugely neglected in terms of oversight, in terms of funding, in terms of accountability.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think it's so neglected?
It's a stigmatized population. You know, stigmatized populations are stigmatized fundamentally. I mean, what does stigma mean, right? Like, what's the end result of stigma? It means that your concerns are invalid to society.
What population are you talking about, just to be clear what you mean?
To a certain degree, yeah. Like if you are a drug addict, as a population would label you, right? You know, you are kind of put into the moral reprobate category.
Right.
Yeah.
And so punishment is appropriate and help is not.
And that's where, like, the tricky thing comes in of, like, you know, so much help and the language of help is, you know, infused in the industry, but it hasn't really gotten over the fact of, like, what does it mean to deal with a stigmatized population? How do we go about discussing the stigma, removing the stigma, creating public understanding? There's been so many fumbles in that. You know, and there's also, you know, a lot of like moral fear and panic around drugs that's decades old.
Yes.
You know, so it's an easily scapegoated population.
I wonder Are the majority of the drug addicts that you see or that you know about from previously stigmatized populations? Because you see LGBT people who are stigmatized to begin with by the society, but I wonder if people tend to towards addiction who are already socially stigmatized, even before they become addicts.
Drug use and compulsive drug use or harmful drug using behavior is available in every sector of society.
Right.
Right? There is no sector of society that is where it doesn't impact people. But you do see a much larger population in those that have, you know, obviously experienced, you know, child abuse, poverty, mental illness, right? Mental health conditions. Yeah. I mean, so LGBT minorities, right? Sex workers, you know, you do see a fairly, you know, those sectors do see a lot more.
Because in that
absolutely
book, in the book Deaths of Despair by Case and Deaton, they say that most addicts now are between 44 and 55 year old men who expected that they'd have some seniority and dignity and don't, because the United States has smashed the working class. But
and I don't
know if that's statistically true now.
Well, I think to a certain degree, I think that's the highest number of suicides.
Yeah.
If I'm correct, right?
It is. Males of that category.
Yeah. You know, and men
white
tend
ones
to succeed in suicide a lot more because they tend to take a lot more definitive.
Yeah, with guns, they tend to use guns.
Right. You know, women tend to, you know, use other methods which have, you know, much lower success rate versus men tend to use much more definitive methods. Oh, absolutely. You know, white men, right, is not necessarily surprising.
No, it isn't. And it has a huge class component, which is
a huge,
always denied or too often denied.
Yeah, there's a huge class component. There's also, I mean, and to a certain degree, I think the class component also comes around to, you know, social connection component.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? And there's also a gender component in that with men.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, even with, you know, well, like, I guess, you know, gay men are a little bit different. Older gay men, you know, tend to have a lot of survivor's guilt.
Mm-hmm.
And also just like lacking a lot of their peers. Their peers died off, you know.
Yeah.
So they have much less people their own age to, you know, bond with and whatnot. So, you know, the gay male population is a little bit different than the straight men, but you know, we did have a lot of, you know, we also did have, you know, heterosexual people come through.
Yeah.
And it is really interesting how, well, and even just, you know, one of the major things about, and I guess that comes into like the family component of our society is, you know, how many people don't have really, like, their only close relationship is their romantic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true, especially in men, you know, and a lot of times, you know, a lot of men, when they get divorced, they end up losing their entire social circle.
Right, because women do the job
of
socially and emotionally connecting men as a rule. And so when they get divorced, women still bond with their friends, they bond with their children, they bond with their relatives, and men are isolated.
Yeah, kind of, you know, adrift.
Yes.
Right? You know, so divorce and, like, you know, how socialization and family is kind of structured in capitalism does definitely end up, in some ways, I think it does. That's one area where I think being, you know, a man has definite disadvantages.
Huge. emotional and social disadvantages.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, just, you know, as a woman, it's, I can have a level of like physical affection with my women friends that, like, you know, most men find kind of impossible.
That's right, because it's branded here.
Right.
It's, you know, it's branded as gay.
I was at some comedy club in LA and they were just like, yeah, I can't remember what the joke was. It's something about like, I can't figure out if you're gay or British, gay or European, you know?
Because it's
that whole idea of like, to be a man in American culture, I think, is a lot more enforced than it is in Europe generally. And French, German, Spanish in comparison to British men are also very different as well.
Yes, and Italians, you know, that there, it's okay to hold hands. It's okay to put your arm around each other. Mm-hmm. It's okay to be tender with one another without being labeled as homosexual, which in the United States is still a term of opprobrium, sadly. No, men are in worse trouble, and they're all the mass killers in the United States are men.
Mm-hmm.
There haven't been any women who do mass shootings. And they're all men who have either been there, who've lost a relationship or lost a job or both.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, because to a certain degree, that is your entire identity.
That's right. As a man.
As a man is like, you know, your worth is, you know, the fact that like you have a woman and a job. Right.
That's right. Yeah. And even the gay guy who killed 49 people in Orlando, Florida, in the nightclub, he had just had a terrible relationship jolt as well and decided to get revenge by killing the gay people in the gay nightclub. That's much more of a male idea to recoup yourself through violence against others, with the allowable emotion being anger, which is not an unmanly emotion for Americans.
Right.
Tenderness is, unless it's in a sexual context.
Right, right. But even then, it's kind of, you know, I grew up as a tomboy, and, you know, the early part of my life, I had girlfriends, but like most of my friends were boys. And I think it was right around, you know, and funny thing, like as a little kid, I used to identify as a boy, and my grandparents were like, you're a kid, you can be whatever you want, we don't care. You know, so that was kind of their attitude towards like, you know, whatever. They're like, you want to be a motorcycle racer, that's fine.
You go, girl.
Yeah, like, you're short, you know, you're not going to do 750 with that height unless you right? You know, so that was kind of like their attitude towards gender. And I, you know, and like I cut my hair short. My mom was like, whatever, you do you. But right around 10 to 12 was when I realized being a boy really sucked. You know, where like I started to get like this really strong impression of how much being a boy sucked, in my opinion, is like, you know, a girl that had mostly boyfriends, but also had like, you know, close relationships with other girls to see the other side, right?
Right. And so, you know, would you specify the ways that being a boy sucked?
I realized, one, that like, as a girl, I could be feminine, right? Wasn't a problem if I wanted to be, you know, and as much as, you know,
girls have a choice.
Right. As much as like, you know, a lot of my interests, like things in sci-fi and whatnot, you know, lean boys, you know, I also like theater. Mm-hmm. You know, I also like costumes and film and dancing. And so like, and as a girl, my access to those things weren't socially impeded. Right. That I could access boy things. I could access girl things. You know, versus like my guy friends, you know, because some of my guy friends were very effeminate, you know, and the amount of harassment, the amount of harassment, like, you know, I used to like have this whole hand signal thing with one of my classmates because he would get his ass kicked in the boys' room. Like consistently, right? You know, and so like we had this whole hand thing where I would go to the bathroom and then he would go to the bathroom and I would let him in the girls' bathroom, watch the girls' bathroom so he could, you know, go piss in peace, right? And then we could go back to class because like it got to the point where like he was terrified of going into the boys' room.
Yeah.
Between classes because that would be where he would get harassed and things like that, like just, you know, talking to a lot of guys and how, like, you know, that was the age where I really started to see like emotional stunting or emotional oppression happening, you know, and that's also the age where like, you know, boys and girls start realizing like, oh, hey, like you're a guy and you're a girl, right? You know, and that kind of distinction from the boys towards the girls and also towards other boys, I was just like, this just all seems so stifling. You know, like men just felt, especially like in the Deep South.
Yes.
Because that was where I was, right? In Tennessee, right? Like I was just like, this just feels really, really oppressive. Like if being a boy to me at that age, like if I wanted to be a boy, like it felt more of a cage.
Yeah.
You know, and
it is more, it is more of a cage because also on teams, if it's a boys team and a boy is not performing well, the coach might say, what's the matter? You're on your period, you're a girl. But they won't say that to a girl. You did really well. What's the matter? Your boy? No, never.
Right.
There's the casting opprobrium of the lesser sex. You know, women are considered the lesser sex, and so that looking like one is an insult. Males are considered the preferable sex, so looking like them is prestigious.
Right.
That stuff is really early Europe to absorb that stuff. I remember in like playgroup, so I'm like 4 years old and we were playing with these toys and they turned out later they were Star Wars toys, right? And at the time I was playing with this one toy I thought was great. The next day I learned that that was Princess Leia and I was like, ugh, I don't want to play with that. Like, how the fuck did I like absorb any of that? You know, like
I mean, observation.
Totally
right.
Between 1.5 and 3 years old, where they've tested this, children know whether they're a male or female and immediately start identifying with the expectations and ideas associated with the sex with which they identify. So that's between 1.5 and 3.
And I think to a certain degree, maybe like, you know, it's, I mean, I spent like the first 5 years in Japan, right? I think maybe part of like the reason that like I had like a little less of the extreme dichotomy in terms of gender was that like I really like kabuki theater. And like that was kind of like to a certain degree, like now looking back, I think that was kind of like to a certain degree my grandma's way of kind of like soft selling femininity to me when I was identifying as a boy, right? Is like she was like, your favorite kabuki actor, you know, isn't he so beautiful in a kimono? Right. And I was like, oh yeah, like he fucking rocks that shit. You're damn right, grandma. Yeah. Like, he's prettier than most girls, you know. It's like, yeah, he really is. He does makeup. So oh yeah, that makeup is fucking awesome. So I think that was like kind of her way of like selling me the, you know, that like it's okay to be feminine too. it really is, because I think she was kind of a little bit bothered by the fact that, like, you know, I was so boyish in my appearance, but she never really, you know, she never really let it on. I think, like, now looking back, that was kind of her low key way, like, selling me femininity through, like, you know, a guy in drag.
That's cute.
basically.
Yeah, and it's when I think back to that toy situation, I think about that if I had been at my house playing, it would have been fine. But because it's playgroup and there's a whole bunch of other boys that I'm playing with, it would have been like, yeah, no one wants to. I remember there was a segregation. It's like when you go out to play, the girls are going to do one lot of play and the boys are doing a whole bunch of other kind of stuff. Right. And it's so, mm-hmm. it's like, it's incredible to my mind now when I think back, like, right back then is when all this stuff is programmed.
It is. It is, yeah. Totally.
In my background, my family, they're all sort of very equal, you know. There's no sort mm-hmm. of like harsh gender roles or divide or anything like that. But I knew it at that age. I knew something. That's weird.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. And, you know, in Sweden and all the Scandinavian countries and the Netherlands, they don't even use male, female pronouns for little kids because they want people to identify as people. And they really make a point of encouraging girls to play with trucks and boys to also play with dolls and to make a gender neutral environment for children. However, they'll notice what's going on outside as well. But those societies are much, much more aware of gender issues and gender equality than the United States is. We have a whole sector of the country, you know, the South and parts of the Midwest that are medieval in their awareness. So it's
a lot more traditional environment in those places, definitely. Yeah,
and the traditions that they uphold are really segregated in terms of gender, race, class, and everything else.
Scary. I think having lived in the South, I actually don't. I think racism can be somewhat more overt there, but I don't think it's any less in places like, you know, growing up north and, you know, living in California now, right? You know, like I've actually probably had people tell me to speak English here in California more than I have in the South. Like if I'm speaking Japanese with my mom, right, in public, I've had a lot more people in California be like, speak fucking English. I'm like, I fucking can't, fuck you.
You know, it brings up for me the question that I have, which is, where do you want to, what kind of issues would you like to address and from what viewpoint would you want to address them in the program?
One of the things that I think would be interesting would be like, you know, also because a lot of people don't understand a lot of mental health conditions, right? They get these diagnoses, they have no idea what it is. You know, and one of the ways I think that we can kind of like also do like an educational component is like, you know, maybe discuss like various diagnoses and talk about like how environmental factors, yeah, social factors, political factors, you know, that pre-exist in those diagnoses, that they're not
That's
free
a wonderful
from,
idea.
From those, you know, because like, you know, I mean, one of, like borderline, for example, you know, because at my facility, like that, I got all the borderline days, right? And, you know, and there is so much, fear and stigma and misinformation and also like gender, you know, diagnosis, right? Borderline is an extremely gender diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, I remember like I was talking to a therapist once on a plane and he ended up doing anger management for domestic violence offenders, right? That was his, you know, he did groups for, court-ordered groups for, you know, domestic violence. And he was just like, you know, like, it's so funny that, like, none of these guys were diagnosed as borderline because they fit the DSM, you know, yeah. But they don't get diagnosed as borderline. He's like, I don't understand, you know.
Yeah. It's fascinating because, like, I came across a book years ago called, like, I Hate You, Don't Leave Me, which was about borderline. Because I had been in a very volatile relationship, one that I hadn't sort of, you know, the dynamic I had never experienced before. And after the fact, discovering that book, it was like, well, this is everything that happened in that relationship. It sort of plays mm-hmm. out. And then it became sort of a way of telling myself a story about the relationship that actually neglected all the sort of environmental factors that might have led this particular person to have dealt with the world in that particular way. But the book right. and the label was very much like, you know, here's just, this is how a person is. It didn't include any sort of social, environmental factors at all.
Right.
It was just purely like, this person has a problem.
And right, right.
And on reflection, when I think about the stories I heard or the history of things that she'd been through, on reflection, it all makes sense. But at the time, it's all just chaos.
That's right, because right. they don't look at how you get there. And the way you get over how you got there is to right. go back. You know, like Hansel and Gretel, go back and see how you come home.
Yeah, the breadcrumbs, right?
That's right.
You follow the breadcrumbs. I mean, it's, you know, border. Oh, God.
Yeah, no, just to sort of finish it off is just like going back to that over subscription to females getting cast this thing. It's like, well, no shit. Like, they're all being labeled with this thing because it's like they're, in theory, for the system, they're acting dysfunctional. But it's like, right. no, they're sort of acting out against things that are pushing against them. You know,
right.
it's
right.
like if you have a sort of patriarchal system, it makes sense that suddenly you're going to diagnose all these women who right. aren't fitting into the boxes you want them to fit into.
Yeah.
Right. You know, it was hysteria of prior years. Now,
yes,
you know,
because now like it's the borderline.
Yeah. Right. Borderline,
right.
like, you know, is kind of almost just like now it's gotten to the point where like it's almost kind of like a throwaway term for like
right.
your crazy ex-girlfriend.
Right.
She's borderline, you know. Like, I mean, that gets tossed out so casually these days, and it kind of, you know, really irks me because I'm like, that's a very specific thing you're talking about there, right?
And that will be a really useful program of the kind that you said you wanted to see, talking about different diagnoses, where they come from, why they are,
right.
the way they are, to whom do they apply, and who gets right. away with their non-application.
You know. Right, and also just like, you know, how it's grossly often misunderstood.
Yes.
Right, like the common misconceptions, right? And also just like, you know, one of the things about diagnosis too is like we have to understand there's a lot of biases that the
yes.
person doing the diagnosis
has. Absolutely.
Has, right. You know, and also just like it's not, I mean, you know, it's not necessarily like a permanent fixed condition that
right.
you are stuck with for the rest of your life that, you know, I mean, same with like, you know.
Anything.
I mean, yeah, it's a huge reason why I kind of, you know, don't like the brain disease model of
right.
you know, compulsive drug use, right? It's one of the clumsy ways of trying to remove stigma.
That's right, but also trying to pigeonhole that
yes.
population and not look at the social ideology.
Right.
Why, you know, why have they, well, conquered addiction by 75% in Portugal? Well, they made it legal. They give everybody counseling. Hey, that helps.
Right.
It's a socialist communist society. That helps.
Right. Well, you know, I mean, calling it a brain disease traps people into thinking it's a permanent condition.
And a medical condition rather
right.
than a psychopolitical condition.
Right. I mean, for some people, it could be. It's just
it
that we
be.
Shouldn't be applying that to everybody without doing
no.
due diligence, right?
And that is an agenda-driven pigeonholing of human beings.
Right. You know, and that is a agenda-driven pigeonholing that we see in mental health in general, but it's a
yes.
biochemical, individualized, internal, you know, strictly
right.
internal, right,
right,
process.
That's right. And
right.
the fact that suddenly, not suddenly, but as the United States empire declines, addiction goes up. Well, why that? You know, what a coincidence, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, because I've, one of the things that's been like, you know, lately irking me is dope sick. I don't know if you've heard of it.
Yep.
Have you heard of it? Okay. Yeah. You know, and it's one of those things where I really should like go back and like, you know, reread the book with like a little bit more rigor instead of rage reading. But and it's one of those things where like people take the people. And I guess what I really don't like out of the book is what people take away from it. That's really wrong, in my opinion, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just kind of like, you know, instead of like the really scary corner street dealer, right? It's now your doctors and pharmaceutical companies. And while they have a huge role to play,
they do,
obviously. But the huge factor is like a lot of these painkiller related, right? So people that are going from pharmaceutical painkiller use mm-hmm. to street drugs,
to heroin,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah. A huge component of that is the fact that we don't have disability, that we force people to work in pain. That, you know, we basically force an entire workforce into chronic injury.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right.
And then once you're a chronic pain patient, pain Whoa. Medication becomes incredibly hard to access, incredibly cumbersome to access. Like for short-term outpatient processes, they give them out like candy. But once Absolutely. You are a chronic pain patient, you are fucking penalized to the gills to access medication.
Because that's where they exercise control. Just don't
Yeah.
prescribe opioids, even when people do have chronic pain because of chronic conditions. And so they go to the letter of this law without looking at the people's pain to whom they're yeah. prescribing.
Right. Yeah. You know, like it was kind of, you know, recently, I think, I can't remember which organization it was, but they were talking about like, you know, reducing opioid, like the prescription for opioid prescriptions for cancer and terminal patients.
Ouch.
Terminal patients went down this year, and they were seeing this as a positive. And I'm like, motherfucker, you're going to like take pain medication out of a terminal patient and call that progress?
Yeah, that's just numerical right? progress without regard to the human beings involved.
You know, but those are kind of like the things that fuel these conversations around prescriptions, right? And that's kind of why I hate the book so much, is because, you know, again, the solution is like, oh, doctors shouldn't be prescribing these things. And it's like, no, that's a blanket reductionism.
Right.
We need to look at why people need them.
Right.
Which is injuries that they have to work through.
Right. And also why they need them and who does become addicted.
Right. Absolutely.
How people get help without that. And so on. That's all fudged.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
The whole idea, right, is to have this conversation so more people in your industries are having this conversation.
Yes.
And then that
yeah.
ultimately leads to some sort of change. And I think that's also something we should talk about with some guests as well. Like, what are the best mechanisms for change in the systems mm-hmm. that everyone is operating in, right?
Good.
It's one thing to talk about it, it's another thing to do it. And I know from previous podcasts or the reading group when Max has previously expressed that as a real tension that he's seen, is that like there's the talking about it and then there's the doing it. And how do you enact all the things that, you know, could fix various problems, either in your industry or sort of just a broader sort of political
sense.
Right.
And so, I think there's a whole discussion or many discussions to be had with various different people about what change looks like and how you do it.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you, Liam, for being the coordinator of all of this. And thank you, Ikoe. This is great. Okay, looking forward Bye-bye, everybody.
By the way, listeners, if you have enjoyed anything you've heard Harriet say in this program, you will definitely enjoy Capitalism Hits Home, which is a solo program that Harriet does through Democracy at Work, which is a worker-owned cooperative that produces other great programs such as Economic Update with Richard Wolf and the Anti-Capitalist Chronicles with David Harvey. I can't recommend enough that everyone also listen to Capitalism Hits Home if you enjoy It's Not Just in Your Head.
Capitalism Hits Home is a sort of broader overhead view. It explores the way that capitalism shapes our personal lives, our psyches, our relationships, our families, and it looks particularly at the sea change in American personal life as all Americans but the top 10 or 20% of Americans have our security and our chance for a future become as precarious as it always was for minorities and families headed by women. It's not just in your head, and Capitalism Hits Home are definitely complementary.
And if listeners would like to check out Capitalism Hits Home, Harriet, where should they go to find it?
Either on YouTube or Democracy at Work or on my own website, harrietfraud.com.